original wisdom, the essence of which is still with us, with some more than others, through no fault, but through teaching and where we come in. And that essence is also deeply rooted in Robert Wolf, a wise old man who wrote a book with that same title, Original Wisdom. It's a treasure, and I promise, so is Robert. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. As you mention in Original Wisdom regarding the Aboriginal cultures, and we are their heirs, yet barely have a clue. So today I feel we, the listening audience, and myself are indeed your heirs and will benefit from hearing about your life. So can you begin with some awarenesses you remember as a youth, sharing approximate dates and where you grew up and how the initial experiences with the Malays affected you?
Well, I grew up in Sumatra. I don't know how much geography people know, but Sumatra is a very large country. They say it's 1,000 islands. I don't think anybody's ever counted it, but there are two very large islands. One is Sumatra, the other is Borneo. I grew up in the very northern eastern part of Sumatra in a small town at that time. Now it's a bigger town, of course. It's a long time ago. You know, I'm talking about the 1920s, and I grew up in the 20s and 30s. And so it was very isolated. There were no planes, of course, so the connection between our little town and Europe, for instance, was 3 weeks until Italy, and then 4 weeks until Amsterdam or London or whatever. My parents were Dutch. When I was 3 years old, I spoke two languages. I spoke Dutch to my parents and Malay to everybody else. We had people working for us. I hate the word servant, but there were people working for us, and they lived in the back of our house. We called it in the back. They would live there with their husbands and their wives and the children and the grandmother, and, you know, it was a little village. And I knew from very early on that that culture, the Malay culture, Malay, by the way, stands for now Malaysia and Indonesia. It's the same language, it's the same culture, although Indonesia has many cultures and many languages and many religions also. Indonesia is known as the country with the most Muslims. There's an island that is mostly Christian, and there are many other islands like Bali, for instance. Very few Muslims in Bali, but they're Buddhist and Hindu. But where we live was Muslim. And so I knew from very early on that I had to speak one language to my parents and another language to the other people. And I also knew, for instance, my mother had very definite ideas about who I was and who I was going to be and what I had to study and all that kind of stuff. And she was quite forceful about that. But the Malays were different, because when I was confused or I was unhappy or something like that, I knew that I could go to the back and there would always be somebody. I could sit on her lap or cry on somebody's shoulder or hold a child's hand, you know, because the Malays, I didn't know that as a child, but they took me as I was and accepted me as I was. And then, you know, I grew up and I went to Europe. My mother sent me to Europe when I had finished high school. I wanted to stay in Indonesia and go to school, but she thought I should go to Europe and get culture. By culture, she meant, you know, museums and concerts and things like that. And so I went to Holland, and I arrived there on the 15th of August, 1939. That was the official year, World War I, World War II began. I was there during the whole war, from the 5th of May, 1940, to the 10th of May, 1945. And it was an awful time. I had to adjust to a new culture and a whole system that was different. And then on top of that, the German occupation is very unpleasant. And so it took me a long time to recover from that. I studied medicine during the war, in the beginning of the war, until the Germans closed the university. And that was, I think, 1943. You remember the important thing there was that during the war, penicillin came up. And so after the war, I realized that I didn't want to do medicine anymore because it had become an entirely different kind of profession. I don't know whether people realize that, but before penicillin, medicine was healing. After penicillin, medicine became a branch of chemistry.
You were so aware to know that at that time. That's
yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah. I've always been aware. I mean, I don't know why, but...
I think it was going out back.
Yeah. I think it was growing up multicultural.
Yes.
You know, it forces you to think about how people think. How people think about reality, how people think they relate to the world, to the planet. You know, after a lot of things after the war, in 1960, I found myself, I had studied psychology in Holland, and then I had a scholarship to go to London, and I studied 1 year in England, and then I got a scholarship to go to the University of Michigan for another PhD in a whole different kind of psychology. The American psychology is all about counting and numbers. And the European culture, in European psychology, you go inside. You know, it's okay to look into your inside and how you think. So you think yourself and being aware with what is going on. Very different. So anyway, in 1960, so this is many years later, I was associate research professor at the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. And I was very lucky to be in a group of people who studied with an English doctor. There were five or six of us, I think. And we studied what we called deep ecology. And I really got into ecology and how everything is related to everything else. It's a very important part of my life. And the University of California got a grant from Congress, no less, to set up one of the International Centers for Medical Research and Training. And so we went to Malaysia, the whole family. I was married at the time. We had four children. And we went to Malaysia. And to my surprise, actually, I found out that the Malaysian culture was exactly the same as the one I knew. Then I found out that when I went to a village, for instance, in Malaysia, and Malaysia is a very fairly civilized country, but I found out that in the villages, they were exactly the same as I expected them to be. They accepted me as I was, and they accepted everything as it was. And that's a very important thing. We don't. Western people don't. I think you understand what I mean?
Of course I do, yes.
And when you have that culture of accepting what is, one of the consequences of that is you can't tell another person what to do.
I know, it's so brilliant. You mentioned with the other Aboriginal culture you got to know so well.
Okay, that's different. The Aboriginal culture is different than the Malay culture. It's more so. It's the same, but more so.
Yes, the fact that they don't tell anyone what to do, basically, after someone is 2 years old, it's beautiful.
But it's true in the Malaysian culture as well as in the Aboriginal culture. Malaysians, too, they don't tell their children what to do. I can give you an example. I can give you many examples, but there was a woman from the World Health Organization who came, and because I spoke Malay, I was asked to show her around, you know, and she gave a talk with slides. It was very complicated. And she was talking about how important it was for children to eat more fruit and things that has vitamin A in it, because if they didn't get enough vitamin A, they would get blind. And so I remember the talk she gave, and she mentioned how important it was to eat spinach. And one of the women in the audience stood up and said, "My child doesn't like spinach." And then the woman from the World Health Organization said, "Oh, I tell you what to do. You take some spinach and you cut it really, really fine and you mix it in with this rice. And then you cook it, and when you finish, you can barely taste the spinach." And the woman kept shaking her hand and she said, "This child doesn't like spinach." You know, the idea of cheating a child just didn't exist. Or for instance, in another village, I was there and I saw this man hiding behind a tree. I said, "Who is that?" And he said, "Oh, he's a thief." I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, he likes to steal." "But what does he do with it?" "Well, he can't do anything with it, so he just drops it, or sometimes he brings it back." I mean, to us, that sounds crazy. You know, they accept everybody as they were.
Yes, and that certainly fit in with how you tell that story in Original Wisdom, your book, about how someone came up to you and said, "Well, we have to find out, why aren't there any Malays in the mental hospital? What's going on here? This must be a mistake."
Yeah, because, you know, nobody thinks that there's anything unusual if they do something like that. When we came to Malaysia, Malaysia had been independent for a year, I think, or 2 years maybe. And they gave us a little pamphlet, and it said Malaysia has 50% Malay and 30% Chinese and 20% Indian. And Indian meant from Pakistan, India, Bangladesh. And the Indians were mostly plantation workers, and the Chinese were, you know, had little shops. But the Chinese had been there for 300 years, you know, but they had no voting rights. And there was a note that there also were Aborigines, Orang Asli, it's called in Malay. And Orang means human, and Asli is ancient, so the ancient people. And they said there were 30,000 of those. I have no idea how we got that. But so I got very curious about wanting to know these people. But nobody knew where they were. So then I met a teacher, and I went to him and talked to him. And I said, "Are you a Malay?" He said, "Well, my father was Malay, but my mother was Aborigine." So I said, "Oh, can you tell me how to reach her, how to meet her?" And he said, "Well, I can tell you how to get there, you know, get where she was a few months ago." I think the story's in the book, yeah?
Yes.
So anyway, that's when I met these Aborigines. The name that I have for them is Senoi. It's usually spelled S-E-N-O-I. I spell it a little differently because it sounded differently to me. The first time I met them, I knew I felt kinship with them. I don't know how to explain that, but in my book I said I fell in love with them. Mm. And that's kind of a silly explanation, but many years later I read a book by Peter Matheson, and Peter Matheson is a travel author. In a book he called The Tree Where Man Was Born, he writes about at the safari, you know, he and a friend go walking on a trip in Kenya, East Africa. They have bearers and guides and things like that. And by chance, they meet five pygmies. Pygmies are also first people. I call First People Aborigines. They're short, they're under 5 feet tall. And the first thing he says about them is their bows are taller than they are. And then he says, they smile at me, and I smile back, and I feel as if my smile is going all the way in my head, all the way around my head.
And into
then
the heart.
He says, I feel as if I'm coming home after being away all my life. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly how I felt. I felt I was coming back to something that all of us are related to in the past, you know, in the way, way far past. I realized I could feel that they were inside me.
What did that do as far as your job as a psychologist? I know it must have been disillusioning by this time, certainly trying to do cross-cultural research, because how do you cross those cultures?
Well, the trouble, the thing is that I've never practiced psychology. I've always worked in public health. And after public health, I have been a writer. I wrote this book and I wrote many other books. I've never practiced psychology. I've used psychology.
Sure.
But I grew up with medicine. My father was a doctor. I grew up with healing medicine, not chemical medicine.
That was lucky for you that you had that experience. You mentioned earlier environments, and you were lucky to be in this ecology from the early 60s. And a habitat is more than an environment, and this sums it up. But what part of this really stands out to you now?
What stands out to me now and what I write about mostly is that what I discovered from the Aborigines, one of the first things I found out, they didn't know the concept of owning. And to us, that is totally impossible to imagine. But they didn't own anything. And when I tried to explain it to them, they just couldn't get it. They have never known the concept of owning. And so later on, I began to think about what that meant. And I realized that humans, the human species, had made a real jump at some point, I think 7,000 years ago, something like that, which is not terribly long ago.
Yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah. We decided that we are different, that we humans do not belong to nature, that we are apart from. By accepting that I can stay in one place, I don't have to be a nomad to find food. The Aborigines lived totally on food they found, food that was growing. They hunted a little bit, but not very much. Their whole life was to use what was. You don't add anything, you don't plant anything, you don't change anything. I'll give you another example. They lived in small groups, not villages, but 12 people, 13, 10 people. And in the morning, very often, they went, I don't know what you call it, but walking around the area and picking a leaf here to eat and a fruit, or they dug up a root or something and they ate that. And I followed a girl one time, and she sang when she was going along. And then when she ate something, she always left something in a tree. And I would ask her, why do you do that? Well, she said, somebody might come along and be hungry. I said, might that somebody be a monkey? Oh, yeah, she said, or a snake. You know, it was all the same. We are the same. We are part of nature. Do you understand what I mean?
Oh, I so understand what you mean. And I don't know how this is going to translate for our listeners, but reading your book, it's not that big a book. So when I got it, I thought, oh, I'll read this in a couple of days and then I'll call you and get an interview. We had spoken and you said you would like to do it, of course. And I couldn't read it like that. And it was almost like I went with my Western self about to gobble this book up. But whatever you bring out from yourself into the book, which gets absorbed by whoever reads it, I couldn't do it. I was totally transformed. I felt like I was living that smile that you're talking about. And
Oh, wonderful.
And I would talk to people while I'm reading your book, and I thought, okay, they're going to think I'm crazy. I'm just obsessed with this book. But the essence of what all of that is just keeps filling me up. I don't know how else to say it. And it's just so fascinating, and I'm so grateful to be able to speak with you about these experiences because they're so real and they're so valid and they're so validating for that being human, for truly being human.
Yeah. You know, after we left Malaysia, we were in Malaysia for 2.5 years, and then I got offered a job in Hawaii. My wife wanted to go back to America, but I didn't want to, so we went to Hawaii. I started to read other people who had written about Aboriginal people or First People, and there are a few, they're not very many. And I found exactly the same things I had been aware of, they wrote about. So it's not unique. It's how we all were before 7,000 years ago.
Yes.
We think of our history as 2,000 years ago. It's actually much longer, of course.
You know, I want to take you back, if we can, to Malaysia for a little bit more. And tell us what the nights were like. You talk about sitting around a fire and how sparse a conversation was. And I wonder, did you make a point to stay up until the last person went to bed all the time?
We went to bed when the sun goes down.
Right.
I mean, pretty much, you know. And you get up when the sun is up. I mean, there's no electricity, there's no artificial anything. In the beginning, I asked a lot of questions, you know, but I would ask one, who is your leader?
Take me to your leader.
always asked. And there was a dead silence. Usually after I asked the question, there was a dead silence. And then one woman said, yeah, I am. And everybody nodded. And then I found out that the woman had come yesterday. And so I said, what's going on? And the woman said, well, I've met Western people before, and I know they want an answer. But they don't have a leader. There is no leader. So eventually I started just stopping asking questions and just watching and being there and experiencing that.
You mentioned that in their language they would use the word learn and not teach. Can you weave your experience of recognizing the true oneness of the world and how you were guided to it?
Well, I feel very strongly that we in our culture are concentrated on completely the wrong thing. Our education, actually, when you think about it, is to force people, children, into our way of thinking. They were the opposite. Let the children learn what they have to learn, like fire is hot, water is wet. But you stand behind them. You stand behind them to catch them if they go into something dangerous or something. But you don't go in front of them. And, you know, I should tell you a funny story, but chickens do the same thing. I found out that mother hens walk behind the flock, not in front of the flock. You let the children learn, and you're behind there. Your job is to protect them, but not to teach them. that make sense?
Oh, yes, it certainly does. And I'd like to share a little story with you about a friend who grew up in the bush in Australia. And he literally grew up naked in the bush with his clan until he was about 13 when the Australian government came along and said, you can't do this. This isn't a good thing. You have to come live in the slums in the city. Mm-hmm. But he said at that time that it was the parents' job solely to love their child, and it was the job of the aunt and uncle to do the disciplining, to keep them in line, so to speak. And not only your mother and father's blood sister and brothers, but anyone that was of that similar age. So basically, mm-hmm. behind every bush, there was someone that was going to help keep you in line. The parents just had to take care of the loving end of things. And
right.
I always love that story and love thinking about that, because we all need help in that arena, I think.
But you know, in the Malaysian culture, and more strongly in the Aboriginal culture, the parents are not important. A child belongs to the village or belongs to the group. It doesn't belong to a parent.
It's so important from the adult viewpoint. How wonderful is that for the children, so they don't grow up thinking their mother and their father are just the moon, you know, they can do no wrong. And I think it just totally takes that piece away, but I love that.
And you know, children who grow up that way, they know that everybody loves them.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, truly. I mean, children are appreciated. Everybody loves them, but there's no discipline as such. I mean, there's no, you must do this, you can't do this. In Malaysia, for instance, they had a big trouble when they started an educational system and we were there, because the Malay children did sometimes, you know, they don't want to go to school, and they don't go, and nobody tells them they have to until the teacher comes and says, where was the child? Well, she didn't feel like it. You know, what do you know about that?
It's like that great story you tell about the rubber plantation, when the government official was wondering, why are these people so lazy? And they were just not getting what the good was to put in a whole plantation of rubber trees and then in 40 years have no soil and no land to let anything
Absolutely.
Else grow. And it's just so lovely how they knew that. Just like
they knew that monoculture doesn't work. And actually, we know that too, you know.
Of course, yes,
but
yes.
They still continue to do that because they can use machines. You grow 2,000 acres of corn. When you grow 2,000 acres of corn, of course, whatever pest there is comes to the 2,000 acres and multiplies. And so then you have to have pesticides and you have to have fertilizer. And so we make it a whole chemical industry.
Yeah. Followed the medical industry, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Obviously, you are carrying that untamable peace that was held by the Malaysians and the Aborigines and the Bushmen, of course, that Lauren Vanderpost speaks about.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are so many years later, and how do you see people either helping others to find this peace or be able to hold it? And it feels different to me than what spirituality is. And I don't know if it's maybe a varying degree of spirituality. I don't know if that's possible, but
no, I think it is different in that I think the ancient way of thinking is so removed from how we live today that in the beginning, I've written other books too, and in the beginning I tried to convince people that they had to change their way of thinking. And now I realize and I accept that you can't. People can't give up their way of life. People can't give up the idea of needing cars or refrigerators or, you know, whatever, government. My personal feeling is that the present way of thinking, which is now worldwide, is so destructive. It's so destructive of the planet, of the ecology, that it's going to crash. and after it crashes, and the crash is going to be awful. I mean, it's really going to be worldwide, not even a disaster, but it's called an extinction by some scientists. I think this human species is in great danger of being extinct. But the planet will survive. But if people will survive, they will have to get back to that ancient way of thinking. I've written several books about that.
What?
The last book I've written is on my website, and it's called Earth Renews. Our thinking is focused on fixing. And when things cannot be fixed, it has to be broken first, and then we have to reinvent the whole thing.
I think that's true. I think just as the government, it got so big that it broke, it tipped over, and now what's coming out of it? Community. So we're getting small farms, we're getting local government, we're getting local food, and it's the outcome. It's like the egg broke, and then look what's inside. It's really amazing.
Yeah. I know many people who have called me or written me email. I've met people who agreed and who understood what I was saying and who are trying to live another way. But it's very difficult in this world. I mean, I know for me, myself, it's difficult. I mean, I have to go shopping for a few things. I eat mostly from what grows around here, but not entirely, of course. And I use a computer, and I have a telephone, and I don't have a car anymore. But, you know, it's very difficult to fix this world. This is a time of process that we can't fix. It has to be destroyed. It's going to be. It's already being destroyed. And then we have to start from scratch.
It is that organic process, isn't it? Because you just said you can't fix it. It needs to dissolve somehow and then be reborn again, I guess. I don't know.
Absolutely. You know, the book, but it's now called Original Wisdom, the first verse of that book, I self-published under the name of What It Is to Be Human.
Mm.
But the whole title was Hope Lies into Our Ability to Bring Back to What It Is to Be Human. And by human, I didn't mean the human of today, but the human originally.
What year was that, Robert?
It came out in 1994.
What have you been doing since you moved to Hawaii? I know it's been quite a few years now, and now I know you just take care of the chicken zoo over there on Hawaii.
No, I don't take care of them. They're wild.
I know.
Take care of themselves.
I know.
No, when we moved to Hawaii, I was a professor of public health. Eventually, I resigned and retired, and then I became a writer. You know, when I left Malaysia, I promised myself that I wouldn't publish anything about the Aborigines for a generation, because I didn't want the whole world to descend on Malaysia and do something with these Aborigines. I felt it was a sort of a holy icon, an icon of an ancient way of living.
Mm-hmm.
But so then I've been writing stories all my life that there was an interlude when I was a professor and had to write scientific stories. And it's very different. I mean, scientific articles.
I mean, how was that for you? Because I know in your book, you talk about, actually to quote from your book, you say language hints at meaning rather than exactness, of allusions rather than pointed information. So what did you mean maybe by talking about allusions, and how did this affect you in your job as a scientist of sorts?
It did, yeah. It affected me very greatly. You know, because science is not about what I'm talking about. Science is counting and measuring and doing all kinds of fancy things. And we're very clever, you know, we can invent all kinds of things, smartphones. But the thing is that when we invent, we never think about consequences. We never think about consequences. And it's the consequences that we should worry about. But I had to learn like a different lifestyle.
Certainly, yes. Maybe we could share one more story about them calling you an elephant and how that affected you, and then how you found out how sweet it really was.
You know, in the beginning, they didn't give me a name at all. From the beginning, I knew they liked me and I could go to other places because, I went to one, I call them settlements. They were not villages, but I call them settlements. And they always said, oh, why didn't you go to, I know another settlement. They would like to know you. And they gave me instructions how to get there. Well, of course, I could never tell them how to get there, or when to get there. But there was always somebody waiting for me, I thought. I discovered they weren't waiting for me, but they just knew something was going to happen. So anyway, found out. I learned a little bit of the language. I have never known very much of the language, but it's amazing how you can communicate. Anyway, I found out they called me elephant. And I was kind of, what do they think? I mean, I didn't know what they meant by elephant. Something big, something, enormous. I don't know. I didn't know what to think. So when one time I was sleeping over in one settlement, and I went to one of the huts, and there was a woman and a child in there. All of a sudden, it got very quiet. And the boy told me, the elephants in the village, they walked me through the village. I couldn't hear anything. Elephants are very quiet. And then so we were in this hut, on stilts, it's high. And all of a sudden, I felt not really something bumping against the hut, but a little bit of a movement, like somebody brushed against the hut. And the boy sort of threw himself on my lap and said, they know you're here. And so after that, nobody called me Allison. And I think I understand what they meant, that I had a big footprint. I was from the West. I had a big footprint. That I could be very quiet and not disturb anybody.
Yeah, you knew how to be.
Yeah, I knew how to fit in.
Robert, what did your wife think of your escapades and with these people? Did she ever go with you, or?
She went with me once, and her only comment or her only what she saw. Was extremely poor people. They had no clothes, they had no drugs, they had no medicines, they had no this, no that. And she didn't understand, she didn't see the beauty of this kind of existence. Mm. My children did, immediately. I mean, they had no problem at all playing with the children there. My wife never saw it, no.
There's a book that Mark Plotkin wrote called The Shaman's Apprentice. He wrote this book maybe 15, 16 years ago by now. He likened that when a shaman would die, it was like having a library burned down. And speaking with you and your firsthand experience with these Aboriginal tribes, can you pull one thing for us that you just don't want to die, that you just want everyone to hear?
Well, I'm quite convinced that the way they live, accepting everything as it is still in us. I know this is still in us. And I know that when things fall apart and crash down, that we will rediscover what that was. And we will rediscover that way of life. I was in World War II, and the last 6 months of World War II under German occupation. We had no food. The Germans stole all the harvest from the farms. And so I survived, we all survived, on tulip bulbs and sugar beets, which is not a very healthy diet, but you know, we all adjusted. We all adapted to that. And I learned then that when the government falls away, for instance, and you have a time without, completely without a government, this happened at the end of the war, nothing changes. We all immediately adapt. That's our great talent as human beings. I mean, when we came from Africa, we went all around the world, and we learned to live in the Arctic, and we learned to live in the desert, and we learned to live on a tiny small island, and we learned to live everywhere, all kind of climates and circumstances. So I know, I have faith, that humans have this capacity to bring back to awareness what it is to be human.
As you can tell, I'm enamored, Robert, with your book, and I'm sorry I'm not familiar with your other books, but I'm sure glad I found this one.
Many thanks to Robert Wolfe. Great title of his book and great reminder about original wisdom. We can be found at tributariesradio.wordpress.com, and our podcasts are where you hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.